Athletes love pushing their limits, but intense training can cause serious imbalances. This is exactly what happened to me. My name is Christopher Kelly. When I first entered the world of competitive mountain biking, I became plagued by numerous chronic health issues. So I changed my diet, and I identified my key imbalances with advanced biomedical testing. Before long, I was feeling and competing better than ever. Now, I'm helping other athletes do the same. Welcome to the Nourish, Balance, Thrive podcast. My very special guest this week is Dr. Brianna Stubbs. Brianna joins HVMN as research lead after completing her PhD in metabolic physiology at the University of Oxford. She was part of the research group led by Professor Kieran Clark that invented and conducted a number of animal and human studies related to the Delta G ketone ester, now commercialized by HVMN. While Brianna was completing her PhD, she was a professional rower with Team Great Britain and a two-time champion at the World Rowing Championships. Since retiring, Brianna has been taking it easy, competing in cycling, running, and triathlon. In her triathlon debut in 2017, she placed first overall and qualified for the USA National Championships. Brianna is a world expert in ketone metabolism and consults with elite sport, military, and clinical organizations. She sets the research agenda at HVMN and forges strategic partnerships with top organizations to improve and create new technologies for human performance. Well, Brianna, thank you so much for hosting me once again in San Francisco. My five-year-old daughter, Ivy, has this delightful thing that I refuse to correct. She calls San Francisco, Fran Francisco.
Oh, dear.
I love it. It's fantastic. She said that we should cancel the trip because it was too foggy.
Too foggy. Down in Santa Cruz or too foggy up here?
Yeah, the sea fog rolled in last night.
Yeah.
Too foggy. That's not a very good reason to not come to San Francisco.
Well, you know, not if you're not going to be able to drive safely up here. Got to watch out for that fog.
Can you give us an update on your racing and training? So for those of you that don't remember the last interview that we did, you were transitioning out of being a world champion rower into the crazy world of triathlon, out of the frying pan, into the fire, I would say.
I don't know why I thought that it would be easier. I mean, I guess now I don't have to turn up at 7:30 a.m. at a designated place with other people. You know, there'd be like almost like an attendance register. It was kind of more like being at school. It was kind of a bit more institutional. So now I still have 15 hours of training a week to do, but I can start at 7 or 6:45. You know, there's just that little bit more flexibility. I can start from my door. I think it's definitely nice being able to be a bit more in control of your training and modulate it a bit. But I think I've got the type of personality that's always looking for that little bit more. So when we last spoke, I was training and racing for some cycling and some running, and it was kind of exciting. I was improving a lot on just the training that I was doing, and I was doing my own thing. I know a fair bit about exercise physiology and how to train, and that was all going pretty well for me. Last season, I did my first half Ironman. And in my first ever half Ironman race, I qualified for the World Championships, which are in South Africa.
Oh,
and
wow.
So, yeah, it was an awesome...
Are you
awesome
going?
6 months. No, I went last year.
Oh, shit. I didn't know. I didn't know it was in South Africa.
No, it was awesome. So I qualified in Mexico, and that was a great trip. And then I had so 6 months or so to prep for South Africa. It was in Port Elizabeth. So I flew into Cape Town, which is really beautiful. And I had a chance to have coffee with Tim Noakes, which was pretty awesome.
Amazing.
Yeah, he's been a fantastic sort of source of interesting ideas and interesting discussion and perspective. You know, he's definitely seen and done a lot of interesting things with his career. And, you know, it was great of him to make time to just sort of meet up with me one-on-one. And I also met, he's a professor at the University of Cape Town. His name is Andrew Bosch. He used to be one of Dr. Noakes's or Professor Noakes's students. And now Dr. Bosch works or is working on like a two-hour marathon project, independent two-hour marathon project called Sub 2. So I had a chance to kind of connect with, do some science nerding out while I was down there. And then went from Cape Town over to Port Elizabeth. Went on safari for a day, which is great. Saw some lions, saw some elephants, and then did the race. It was pretty good. I definitely have a lot to learn. I think competing in a provincial Ironman, like one of the smaller races, there's not the depth of field that there is at the World Championships because everyone is qualified. But it's very cool to be, you know, there's such a big buzz at the venue, and it was pretty inspiring to see so many people of different ages competing. And they had the women's race on the Saturday, the men's race on the Sunday, so we were able to actually watch the men's elite race and get really up close and personal to those guys as they were doing the run, which was pretty awesome. And for myself, I came in the top half of people in my age group, where I think I'd have liked to have done a little bit better, but I think it was a decent result.
How do you decide that, though? I always think, like, it's so arbitrary, isn't it? You come up with this idea that, oh, this is the time I have to meet. This is the position I have to
finish. Well, that varies course to course, right? Especially on an Ironman. If you've got wind or something on the bike, it's going to slow you down a lot. But I think one of my biggest mistakes that probably everyone listening who competes in triathlon will kind of, like, shake their head at this, but I ended up with a drafting penalty.
Oh, shit.
I think it's 5 minutes. Which is not a small amount of time.
So how long? Was it deliberate?
No, it was so frustrating because starting off on the bike, there were tons of people everywhere and it was like absolutely unavoidable to be drafting. And I road ride quite a bit and I ride road riding groups quite a bit. So I'm pretty comfortable inches away from people's wheels. So in the initial part of the race, the road was absolutely full. So I was drafting and moving up through the group and I was like, well, you know, like everyone's drafting, so like they can't get everyone. And then it started to string out and we were on this sort of like long straight road and it's a 10 bike lengths. It's a really long distance that you're not meant to be within people. It's difficult to kind of judge that. And in any case, so there was this one woman who overtook me and then would slow down and I was overtaking. I wasn't really paying that much attention, but people aren't particularly consistent in triathlon, and I feel like I'm quite consistent. Anyway, I ended up, this woman overtook me again, and I was moving back up to her, and that was when I got pulled up. It's hard to know whether or not you're a violation of that rule, but that was an easy 5 minutes that I just gave away. I still did a PR time, but I mean, it was only my second one, so it's not like, and it was, you know, decent. I enjoyed the experience and the event. It was good.
And you're going to stick with it?
So right now, I'm training for a full Ironman. So this weekend, I'm racing a half Ironman as sort of like a prep race. For me, it's sort of like a bucket list thing. I really want to see how it feels to compete in that event.
I really want to feel what it's like to completely tank my hormones.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I've got 6 months of this in me. And I've started working with Leslie Patterson, who I know you've had on
course,
the podcast for a bit of time.
Yeah.
And that was definitely a big step on for me, from just setting my own training to getting a coach and getting some structure. And now it feels a bit more like with the rowing training, where I go out and all of the sessions have got prescribed work and zones. And I have the energy for this for a short amount of time. And I know how to do it from my past. But the ultimate goal will be to qualify for Kona this time around. That's what I'm really like training really hard for. And if I can do that, then I'll compete there this year and then maybe move on to a different challenge. You know, I did my first marathon in December as well, and I'm enjoying running. And here in Northern California, there's a really great bike racing scene, and I'd love to do some stage racing and some time trial. I think I'm pretty good at that. I'm not super tactical just yet, so I think the time trialing would be a pretty good event for me. So we'll see. There's an endless world of possibilities in sport, and I'm excited to explore them all, but it seems like a good time to be building on the half Ironman, do the full distance, see how I enjoy it. I don't know that I'm going to be a career triathlete. I've kind of done my professional sport, but it's interesting how many successful business people are in triathlon. Mainly, I think it's interesting because they have so much on in the rest of their lives, they shoehorn this training around.
Yeah,
but it's sort of this like
incredible?
It's this type A kind of person who's super driven and kind of a bit of a lone wolf maybe and into data. And so it's interesting for me to get a peek into that kind of character.
I struggle with one sport, let alone three.
It's who what? It's tough trying to balance all three. And back when I was training previously for my half Ironman and setting my own stuff, I only swam once a week. And I was training maybe twice some days, but mainly once. And now, you know, when setting on Les's program, it's pretty punishing fitting it all in. And you definitely feel like you're compromising your progress in each of the individual sports you could be progressing for. But, you know, swimming now more with Les's program, and I feel like my swimming's really progressed, and doing more structured cycling, and I feel like that's really progressed. So I don't feel like I've got that much better at running on this training program, but I think I got a lot better at running when I was training for the marathon and running every single day.
That's great.
Yeah. So, yeah, I ran a 3:15 marathon. It's not too bad for the first one. Well, 3:14. So under that cutoff, qualify for Boston. Maybe I'll train for that next.
Oh, wow. Blimey. Yeah. Listen to her. Maybe I'll train for that next.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've qualified, so maybe I'll just see if I can go faster.
So do you take the ketone ester when you're doing a triathlon?
Yeah, so I tend to take it in transition one, because sometimes it, like, the kind of like buzzy feeling that it gives me when you're also getting in cold water and like there's a lot going on. And I don't know, swimming is a bit of a weird alien environment, and more so in the open water than in a pool. It's not sort of, there's just a lot going on. And so I don't want to be too zippy in the water. I just want to be quite tranquil.
Right.
And I feel like the swim, especially in a half Ironman, it's 35 minutes. In a full Ironman, it's about an hour. So it's very different to the cycling and running, so I don't feel like metabolically I'm at that stage in the race. You don't need to take on any extra fuel, as well as I, so I take it on the start of the bike for the half Ironman, and I really feel like it kind of gets me through that first couple of hours of the bike in much better shape than than otherwise.
You better tell us your exact dosing regime now, because people are going to be asking or
wondering. I take one bottle, just because it's much easier to take the one serving rather than be like measuring out more or less. But I also would take it with carbs on the bike as well. So I'll have electrolytes and a little bit of carbohydrate in the bottle and try and take on fuel every sort of 45 minutes or so. I'm definitely not running it. I do a lot of fasted training. Lots of my training, you know, like 3 days a week, maybe I'll train in the morning after an overnight fast. So I would say that I'm still like pretty metabolically flexible, but in the race, I'm trying to make sure that I drip in some carbs during that time.
Yeah, all the energy from all the sources.
Yeah, well, you need it when you're going to go for 10 hours on an Ironman.
Yeah. Do you find it hard to fuel at that level when you're used to, I'm sure you don't eat a lot of stuff when you're going out for a...
No, but I think in a way that means that when I do fuel even just 50% better, I feel freaking awesome.
Yeah.
Like, I don't really like goo shots or anything like that. And I prefer bars and like real food. And especially when you're doing like a long distance triathlon, it's not ever so intense that you're going to, it's a cumulative intensity. It's not like you're doing sprints or anything like that. So you kind of got the breath and the feeling in my body that I can eat a bar and digest it, or eat like a PB&J, like a little sandwich or something. You know, I can have some real food, nuts or something like that, banana or whatever you can carry with you. And I prefer to eat that than I would to just drink energy drinks. I mean, with a half Ironman, when I get to the run, I switch on to gels.
Okay.
Just get me through that last little bit. Like, kind of, you need a bit more instant energy source.
I envy you that. On the mountain bike, I think I'd die if I try to eat anything. It's just
but
like,
you guys, that's like sprint and then stop and sprint. Yeah, you can't. It's more
it's
much.
Relentless.
Triathlon is much more like rowing, in that it's just like how much wattage can you put out for the set period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So you just have to sort of sit and produce the power on the bike and drip it in. You don't need to sprint to get ahead of anyone.
And so, what other applications are there for the Keto Nestor? It's been a while since we spoke. Who's been using it and what for?
So, I mean, in terms of sport, we've been working with football teams, like American football teams. We've been working with elite cyclists. A number of teams from the Tour de France are using it. And it's been really cool to see not only the teams buying it, but a number of the individual athletes come to us and buy it as well. We're really excited to see that market kind of continue to grow. We've supplied a few basketball teams and a few, just some, a lot of people in it, sort of the elite level sport, are early adopters and just trying it out. Some baseball players, some fighting, from fighting sports as well.
Okay. Ooh, and what are the fighters and the American football players, are they more interested in the ketone as an energy substrate, or are they interested in the neuroprotective properties?
Well, I mean, yeah. So, I mean, there's different ways you could look at it. So some people are using it more for the kind of steady energy feeling and cognitive boost that they feel like they have. And in a way, that's supported by some of the preliminary data. So Brendan Egan published a paper looking at decision making, like higher order cognitive functions after ketone ester drinks, and they're seeing, you know, improvements there. And that's consistent with what we've seen with our research that we've done with the military. With the more complicated the task gets, the more likely you are to see a difference with ketone ester once you put a stressor in there. There's definitely some signal there that the decision-making cognitive function may be improved in that kind of setting. To me, it would be quite interesting to compare it to, say, caffeine or, you know, another like stimulant, right?
Cause something where you feel something. An active placebo, they
call that. You know, I suppose in most cases, they're comparing it to carbs and glucose. So, I mean, that's something at the very least. So I think people are interested in thinking clearer. But then also, as you alluded to, there's the neuroprotective component. And I think the more people get into the basic science there and look at all of the animal work that's been done, the more people believe it. But we're still not there with having like a really robust human studies to support that. So, I mean, it just makes total sense when you look at, yeah, like I said, the animal work where they'll like lesion parts of the brain or make parts of the brain hypoxic and then look at brain ATP levels with and without extra ketones in on top of that. And there's just this huge rescue of brain ATP levels when ketones are also present. And so the basic mechanism that goes with hypoxic or traumatic injuries is you get the insult itself causes like tissue damage and harm. And then you have sort of secondary phases of injury where there's hyperexcitability, oxidative stress, and hypoglucose metabolism. And in that time, the parts of the brain get energy starved and ketones can rescue. That is what a number of these studies have shown.
Why is it that it seems to be glucose metabolism that gets impaired and then you can still use lactate and ketones and other things?
Well, I mean, part of it could be insulin sensitivity, like breakdown of the insulin signaling in the brain that's going to affect glucose uptake, but also it could
be... Is that relevant, though, if, like, the cell is screaming out for energy? Like, is insulin really going to have any say in that? I don't...
But, I mean, people call Alzheimer's disease, which is, you know, again, compromised brain energy metabolism, they call that type 3 diabetes. Right. And there's a higher incidence of it in people where there's insulin insensitivity as well. So, I mean, I think at this stage, we can't rule out that something happens to the insulin signaling pathway that compromises that action. And that would explain why it's just glucose. Or another potential point of regulation would be pyruvate dehydrogenase and sort of actually affecting in that as well. So I think at this stage, maybe we know a little bit about it, but I think it's maybe still being
an area of...
Yeah.
Can you talk about some of the research you've done with the military? Is any of that published?
It's not published yet. So we're just working on extending that into another research effort with them, but we certainly plan to write up our findings, and people can actually find this online, so I can talk about this. This is public. We were awarded some funds from the US military to look at ketones in hypoxia. So we would give people ketone drinks, turn down the oxygen, and make them solve cognitive puzzles. Again, you know, as I mentioned before, we found similar results in that higher order cognitive tasks were sort of, ketones were protective against the hypoxia induced decline in cognitive performance.
So what would induce hypoxia in the real world application?
Well, I mean, if in the military they're doing either missions at altitude, being dropped, or the recent problems with some of the air systems in some of the planes. So there's a few things where I'm diving as well. There's a number of kind of extreme environment settings. But for me, I kind of look at hypoxia as a tool to stress the brain and allow us to tease out subtle differences that might be difficult to measure otherwise. When we conceived the exercise studies in Oxford, that we were looking for changes in performance with ketones, we wanted to use exercise as a metabolic stressor that makes energy scarce, or, you know, changes the balance between energy supply and demand in a way that mimics disease in some case. There's, you know, a mismatch between supply and demand, and then we can see how ketones are affecting that. And so it's similar here. Rather than exercise as like a physical stress, in order to stress the brain, we're turning down the oxygen. That makes it harder for the brain to operate. And so we see cognitive performance in a number of domains tailing off. And if we mitigate that by ketones, then we're doing something, whether that's providing the extra substrate or sparing, you know, acutely decreasing like oxidative stress or any number of things that could be actually helping with that cognitive performance.
Talk about the 1 hour cycling record.
Yeah, so that was one of my favorite things that we've worked on in the last year. So it's kind of a roundabout story. So I was studying in Oxford, and there were team members who was helping run the experiments was a cycling coach. And then he gets back in touch with me recently, and he's still coaching cycling, not researching ketones anymore. And he's like, I am coaching this athlete who is trying to break the 1 hour velodrome world record. That record is somewhat legendary. You know, Bradley Wiggins has gone after it, very decorated British Olympic cyclist. And back in the early days of when the record was sort of conceived, there were all these innovations around the bike positioning. And the guy who, I'm going to get it wrong, but I want to say it was like Greg LeMond, who made his bike out of washing machine parts. And there was a lot of...
I know you mean. You mean the Flying Scotsman,
yes,
don't you?
Yes, that's it. Is it Greg LeMond? No.
No, it's not. I'll look his name up. So that's a really interesting movie that I've watched.
Oh, no, you're going to need to be more specific than that. Cycling. You're just getting... Chris has put Flying Scotsman in, and it says the train.
Graham O'Bree, of course, the Flying Scotsman.
Yeah, but so we're looking at pictures of him. You can see that super aggressive aero position, and he was very innovative. So it's a really storied record, a very cool record.
That's right. And then I think if I remember correctly, the UCI changed the rules in 2014. Mm-hmm. Jens Voigt got the record.
Shut up legs.
And that was in his final retirement year, right? And then a bunch of other cyclists came along and bettered it.
Yeah.
But that was why the UCI, they kind of relaxed the rules, because it'd been silly for a long time where you couldn't even have a heart monitor or a power meter or anything. And then in 2014, they changed the rules again and then everybody...
Yeah, so recently, as you say, because the rules changed, more people have been going after this record and breaking it. And so Victoria is sort of similar to me in that she did her PhD at Oxford. She's a math PhD, super intelligent, just the sort of mind where numbers are like colors to her. You know, she's Italian as well, so she could talk about it all very romantic, you know, how she felt about maths. And so that's how she'd ended up connected with the guy who I used to work with, and he was coaching her. She started cycling at Oxford. She wasn't like a lifelong athlete, but she was just very, very talented and was sort of in the process of trying to break into the international team, trying to break into professional teams, and as part of that, training on the track to break the 1 hour record. And it was kind of a unique opportunity because she had so much data on herself and could really see what was moving the needle for her. And her coach, who I'd worked with, was like, it'd be really interesting to try ketones. And interesting, because if you take a step back an hour, it's not going to be completely limited by glycogen. You know, even if you're going quite intensely, it's going to be on the borderline of whether or not you need to be taking on substrate for that. But what we do know about ketone ester sparing glycogen and lowering lactate in the short term, that's all kind of interesting for an event like this. And then to link in what we were just talking about, the potential kind of focus element and cognitive element was actually something that Victoria said she felt the most. So, I mean, we worked with her titrating up and down her doses, and we were looking at her power numbers with the ketones, and we were working on her with trying it out in different settings. And she was like, look, I've just got to try. I'm going to do the same session, but I'm going to do it without ketones because I'm not really sure if this is helping me or not. And she did the session, and the next morning I woke up and there was a message, and she was like, absolutely, it makes a difference. I really noticed a difference not having had it. And I was surprised, because pleasantly surprised, that she really noticed that much of a difference with and without. But she would say that she'd be on the track focusing on the black line, because you want to be as near into the center of the track as possible, taking the tightest line. And she said, you know, you're just in that position, really on the edge of what's possible, a really uncomfortable aero position for an hour. And that mental component was really important to her.
Yeah, and of course, you mentioned Tim Noakes. If you subscribe to his central governor model of fatigue, then it's not an all or nothing thing, right? Your brain senses an energy crisis. Yep. It's not going to wait until you run out of glycogen before it asks you to slow down. And in fact, one of his PhD students has shown this in the lab, that cyclists go slower from the first pedal stroke when you put them in a hot laboratory.
Yeah, right? Sure. There's so many interesting experiments about how the mind affects the output of the body. I don't know whether it's building on the same study that you just mentioned, but there's one where letting people sit, having cold water in their mouth, reduces the perception of effort, improves performance. They don't even have to drink it. It's very interesting.
And it's the same with the carbohydrate solutions, right?
Wash
They've
it
done
in your mouth.
That mouthwash. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's been shown to be effective too.
So Victoria was training with the ketone ester, really getting on well with it. She's going to do the attempt in Aguascalientes in Mexico, or she was. This is happened August last year. So she goes up there. She's at altitude as well. It's interesting, the choice of location for these attempts, because there's a trade-off between air resistance and oxygen. So Aguascalientes is not that high. It's sort of medium high.
Right.
But the air resistance is that much less that you go. This velodrome has been the site of a number of attempts.
Right.
It's fast velodrome.
Yeah, I've heard even the audience participation makes a difference. So you want the air warmer, less resistance, but not so warm that it affects the cooling of the athlete. Yeah, so they get people in at the exact right time. Yeah. Like, okay, cheer a bit more. Let the temperature up just a little bit.
If you want to make it an event, like you just suggested, and have people watch or have press, the UCI charge a fee. So she was just doing it on her own in the velodrome. Oh. No one watching other than her partner and some small amount of media. But she gets up there and she starts off an attempt. And so a little like you said, actually, a lot of it was we were on hold because it was like, when's the air pressure going to be correct? Because there were storms coming and she only had the velodrome hired for a certain window of time. And it was all, everyone was sort of on the edge of their seats waiting for the attempt to be given the green light. And so she took a window and started the attempt, and she got 45 minutes in and stopped. And we were following her. And, you know, 45 minutes in is not an insignificant amount into the 1 hour.
I'd say you got
attempt.
Significant sunk costs at that
point. Yeah. So, I mean, that was from our end. We were just hoping that she was okay. And she just said to us that she wasn't feeling it. And she went back the next day. So not very, you know, this is the second time that this has happened. One other person has made an attempt. I don't know whether that other person got all the way through or whether he stopped early, but she goes one day, takes ketones, and we think that ketones help with recovery, and then into the next day makes the attempt, and we're there like looking at her lap times popping up, and she gets to the 45 minute point where she stopped the day before, and she just starts speeding up, and it's like,
that's great.
Okay. So she broke the record by a matter of meters.
Wow.
But it was very cool to have supported her with that, and also just, I'm sure that ketone helped, but you know, she obviously put in so much work and was mentally very tough as well, and we're not going to own all of that. She did a lot of work.
Yeah,
but it was a great validation to see that she could use it and that she felt like it helped her. And maybe it did make a bit of the difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul Larson, when he talked about high-intensity interval training on the podcast recently, he talked about HIIT being one piece of the performance puzzle,
right?
Oh,
for sure.
And it's not silver bullet anything.
No. I think she had to get a lot of things right. And when you're an athlete and reflecting on like my own time, it's like you just want to stack up as many of the things like in your plus points as possible. You want to have good nutrition, good hydration, the right equipment, the right sleep the night before. Mm-hmm. I think you know, you're a great advocate for looking at a system kind of holistically.
Exactly. Systems approach.
Yeah. So it was good to be part of that.
Talk about some of the potential therapeutic applications of the ketone ester. Has anyone been looking at that in neurodegenerative disease or anything else like that?
Yeah, so we have a number of researchers that are in touch with us looking to use ketone esters for various clinical things. And the applications are very wide ranging, through from genetic disorders of glycogen metabolism, for example, looking at if ketones can bypass that defect, through to alcohol withdrawal and if ketones could help to mitigate the harmful or negative symptoms of withdrawal. And again, the logic there is a little like what we were talking about with TBI, where the brain in an alcoholic becomes sort of somewhat dependent on energy from ethanol and acetone because you're drinking alcohol a lot, and then you remove that to go cold turkey and the brain is energy starved. And they've actually shown that the ketogenic diet can help in that case.
Okay.
So it's something that's very interesting.
And there's no mechanism involving GABA?
Potentially. I mean, yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. There's potentially a role there as well. GABA or oxidative stress or DNA damage, number of things.
Okay.
But this is very exploratory. I mean, I think there is a group looking to use the ketone ester in humans for that, but it'd be interesting to do the experiments with ketone ester and or ketone salts in animals as well, just so we could get a bit more insight into the mechanism.
So this is really just getting started, people writing grants, that type of thing.
Yeah, and I hear a lot from different people, a lot of people in exercise physiology as well, people running training studies and starting to get in some results in there that are really, really promising, showing that ketones can help mitigate overreaching and things like that. It's really promising. So I think we're getting to a point where we understand that metabolism and substrate provision is central to a number of disease processes, and that ketones in some of those processes can be helpful. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that's sort of particular.
Nothing in Alzheimer's or Parkinson's? Or
we are working on Alzheimer's as well. We've been speaking to Dr. Stephen Cunane up in Sherbrooke, Canada, and hopefully having a project underway with him to look at. He recently published a paper using MCTs and looking at feeding MCTs 3 times a day, and they maintain blood ketone levels around about 0.6. It was definitely under 1. Maybe it was 0.8. It was.
And that's not in a carbohydrate-restricted diet?
Not in a carbohydrate-restricted diet. Supplemental MCTs. And his specialty is using FDG, PET for glucose, and also PET for ketone metabolism. So he's got these labeled metabolites, can inject them into people, and then look at where, at how much is being metabolized in the brain.
Oh, wow.
And so he really pioneered the studies that showed that glucose metabolism starts to decline even before you have symptoms of Alzheimer's in people. So you could be 5 years before you actually have symptoms and are diagnosed and your brain glucose metabolism is falling. But then with his more recent work, he showed that ketone metabolism doesn't fall in these people, or ketone metabolic capacity remains the same. And then if you supplement with ketones, you can mitigate some of that energy deficit that's coming through the slow decline of glucose metabolism. And so his studies with MCTs were really promising. They did 6 months of 3 drinks a day, and they looked at not only metabolism of glucose and of ketones, but also cognition as well. And they saw that changes in cognitive function correlated really nicely with blood ketone levels and ketone metabolism.
So wait, you said 3 drinks a day?
Yeah, I think it was 30 grams of MCT a day, something
okay.
like that.
Okay, so maybe. Do you know what blood level of BHB?
So yeah, 0.6 to 0.8.
So not much. So what would be the advantage of using the ester over the MCT?
Well, if we see from his results that we're getting, I can't remember off the top of my head, don't quote me on this, I believe they rescued 25% of the energy deficit. They partially rescued the brain energy deficit with that level of ketosis. And so the logic is that by having greater levels of ketones, that will more completely rescue the energy deficit by providing more substrate.
Right. And so with the ester, you can raise blood BHB to whatever you want. You can't really do that with the oil.
Yeah, or with salts at this stage. So I think that this will be a really interesting study, because we don't know whether there is like an upper limit to, you know, if you carry on providing more ketones, is the benefit going to continue to accrue linearly? Or is there going to be no difference between having people at 0.6 and 2? So this will be interesting. Our hypothesis is that greater ketones is greater substrate provision and then therefore greater brain energy rescue. So we'll see if that's borne out in the results. And then another big thing that we'll be working on is just seeing if this is like a practical and tolerable intervention for people. Because I don't know how many of your listeners will have tried the ketone ester, but I know you have, and I have myself. And you kind of...
Yeah, but I only tried Uncle Frank's special blend, right? I've not done the legit thing.
You haven't tried it?
No. It's a little bit out of my price range, I have to say.
No, I mean, it's out of most people's price range. So that, as a business, that's something that we're working on.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, you've put a lot of money. I mean, decades of research went into this product, and I think people like me will benefit later on once the price comes. I hope the price will come down. Yeah. You would have thought so.
Well, it's there's a clear roadmap to do that with scale. If we multiply our order size, our manufacture size by 10, then the cost comes down by half, for example. You can work out or something like that with scale. And we hope to be able to do that soon. Yeah, it's just a practical problem. You know, you need the cash flow to do that.
Right. And do you know if anyone's looking at it as, how can I put this? A nootropic, perhaps? So just a normal person. Can you improve cognitive function with the ester, without disease?
Well, I think a number of our community are using it for a mental boost. We actually have a big kind of institutional customer that are concierge coaches for executives. And so they're looking for the mental edge in and around their job. And these people, they travel a lot, transmeridian travel and dealing with jet lag and whatnot. And some of the feedback we've been getting from them is that this has been a really useful part of their toolkit to help people function cognitively in situations where they might otherwise be sort of tired and frazzled. So yes, I mean, the short answer is that a lot of people associate the feeling of ketosis with that mental clarity and focus, and the anecdotal feedback that we get from people is that people experience that with the ester. I would say it's been one of my questions that I would love to see answered is why some people really, really do feel it and experience it. And I know I feel it myself and other people don't, whether that's to do with metabolic flexibility or age or habitual diet. Or I would love it if I gave it to everyone and I was 100% sure. I'm 100% sure when I give it to anyone, it's going to raise their ketone levels. Like, I could put my hand on the Bible. I would stake my life on, I give you a drink of ketone ester and your blood ketone levels will go up by some measure, 1 to 2 to 3 millimoles, depending on how much I give you. But the subjective thing, which actually is more important in terms of getting it out there more and making people want to implement it in their lives, that's sort of a little more hit and miss. Mm-hmm. I'd say like 7 out of 10 people feel something. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to know why those other 3 don't.
It's the MCT, the transporter.
Yeah, maybe it's MCT isoforms as well.
We're used to using lactate, right? This was you that pointed this out to me the first time many moons ago.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, lactate's interesting in that it uses the same transporter as ketones, the monocarboxylate transporter. You can't use the acronym MCTs.
MCT because it's overloaded, right?
I know. So Tommy and I were just working on a review together, and one of the changes, because he'd been talking about MCTs, medium chain triglycerides, and MCTs, monocarboxylate transporters, and I was like, look, we have to call MCTs, medium chain fatty acids, MCFA, or something. We changed one of the acronyms so that it was not confusing, because it's a bit, I think people in the space get a bit confused.
Talk about lactate.
Yeah, so I mean, it's something that I'm personally interested in. As we mentioned, I've been working more and more with the military, and they're really, really interested in TBI prevention, because as a part of the course of duty of many of these operators, they're either being exposed to explosions, that's not quite what I was going to say, but blast kind of injuries. Or, for example, in parachute school, they'll be learning to parachute jump, and there's always the real risk that they could have a blow to the head and end up with concussion. And it's something that some of the operators that we've worked with personally, some of them have had multiple concussions, and it really affects their quality of life now. And I'm really pleased to be able to say that it seems like the American DOD is focusing more and more attention on like soldier resilience and actually looking after the people that they have and protecting the investment they've made in those people versus just trying to have a conveyor belt coming through. So this is kind of a hot topic. What could we do to mitigate TBI? And obviously we've discussed ketones, one potential solution there. But if we look at the principles as to why ketones are working, the substrate sort of potentially triggering BDNF release and some of the other effects of these altering metabolism, actually lactate does a number of the same things. And there's a number of clinical trials of lactate in intensive care showing improved outcomes with lactate infusion, because if you look at the structures of the molecules, lactate and BHB are not all that different. I think they're just one carbon different.
Okay.
I mean, they're both organic acids and they're both shortcutting in a number of the kind of regulated processes of metabolism, whether it's like insulin mediated uptake or the different regulated steps of glycolysis, and then fatty acids as well. They're kind of regulated on a number of levels before the mitochondria, whereas ketones and lactate being smaller and less regulated, they're quite a ready substrate that can be available in times of kind of energetic crisis that bypass some of the steps that get shut down. And so, yeah, it was interesting. I saw a review by Professor George Brooks, who's actually just around the corner from us here. So we're in San Francisco. He's at UC Berkeley. I read this review. It was really, really, really long and a lot of brain work. And then I ended up going out to meet with Professor Brooks and just spent the whole afternoon
geeking
out about the potential for synergy between the two, ways that they might compete maybe. You know, as we were just talking about monocarb oxalate transporters, both ketones and lactate use the same transporter. So is that going to be good or is that going to be bad? Is there different kinetics?
Are they going to compete potentially?
Maybe, potentially. But maybe not also because they have different affinities for the transporter.
Okay.
It's very interesting because you and I were talking before about how both lactate and ketones are kind of a little bit outlawed in metabolism.
Yeah.
There's actually a paper that calls ketones metabolism's ugly duckling. And I think that that's definitely true for ketones, but it's also kind of true for lactate. And as an athlete, I mean, I had a more sophisticated understanding than most of the other athletes on the British rowing team, but we always would measure lactate. And also after like really intense workouts, we'd be trying to clear lactate and get your lactate levels down. And like lactate for an athlete is this super like villainized thing where
right.
it's like, well, I have high lactate and that's what makes me fatigued and that's what makes me sore. And that's what, but actually in reality, it's not the case.
Right. It's the protons what done it.
Yes. But also, and if you read this review by Brooks, he says that there's no clear evidence that when you produce lactate, that there's an associated proton produced. So the proton production
right.
and the, you know, like after lactate is produced, they associate, but there's no clear evidence that cholysis is a proton producing pathway.
Right, right.
Which is interesting to me because I just, there's so many things I just assumed were a given.
Yeah, so to go back to Paul Larson again, that's one of the things he defines with his high intensity interval training is a blood accumulation of lactate. But in the Brook paper you sent me, that was something I didn't know, was actually there's a continuous production of lactate. So
at
it's
rest,
really
even.
Just, yeah. So it's another really interesting story. Malcolm Kendrick talked about this, that humans have a terrible habit of turning up at the scene of a crime and then accusing the thing that they find at the scene of the crime yeah. as being the perpetrator of the crime.
Mm-hmm. So it's like cholesterol, right?
Exactly. So that's Malcolm Kendrick's context, yeah. is cholesterol. And again, we've done it with lactate or lactic acid.
But it's very interesting because if you read this review that I'm sure we'll link to in the show notes, the historical context is the very earliest sort of exercise physiology experiments or various earliest muscle physiology experiments looking at lactate would take like a hind limb of, I think it was a frog, and stimulate it until it was fatigued. And they measured the lactate and they were like, this is it. And that, then that colors everything that has happened since then.
Yeah.
Those, you know, those very,
so it's
very
entirely anaerobic.
Uh-huh. It's just so interesting to me that the precedent is set by these like old grandfathers of physiology, and they set how people think about these things.
Right.
And then it's very difficult to subsequently change that because it's taken as a given that lactate causes fatigue.
Right. Very fixed mindset.
Yeah, very fixed mindset. So I personally, there are products, sports drinks products that contain small amounts of lactate, and that's kind of something that I find interesting to, they actually have one research study where they gave this sports drink that had lactate in it, lactate, fructose, glucose, so it was multiple transportable carbohydrate forms, and it was a very elegant experiment because they labeled the glucose, the fructose, and the lactate. So the people came back three times, and they, one, the glucose was labeled, one, the fructose was labeled, one, the lactate was labeled, and then they had a control where they just had, was it just glucose? But they saw that actually adding in lactate improved and increased the oxidation of both glucose and fructose. Not sure whether that's to do with like gut transport, but it, so lactate was increasing carbohydrate usage and being oxidized itself very, very rapidly. And they saw an improvement in, it was a shorter time trial. Was it time to exhaustion? They did a performance test and there was some improvement. And I was surprised when I saw this paper that there wasn't more done on this. But then sometimes things just like fall by the wayside with science. So maybe there's a real effect, but we would need more studies. But it's certainly interesting to me from a performance point of view, if we buy into the idea that really what we want to do with performance nutrition is provide the body with a choice of substrates, not really shut down too many substrates, provide the appropriate substrate for the exercise that's being undertaken. So yeah, that would be interesting. But then also kind of lactate in terms of brain injury as well is tremendously interesting. And Professor Brooks is, you know, funded by groups that are interested in TBI protection and head injury protection. So I mean, for me, I think really a great end outcome would be that there is some kind of drink or product that people can have on the sideline. You know, you're a soccer mom and you go to watch your kid play and they take a hit. There's something that you can do that's actually actively going to help them in the short term, protect them. It doesn't need to be go to hospital and have infusions of ketones or lactate. You know, if we know it's going to move the needle a little bit, I think that it would be great to see these things being more accessible and being more understood.
First responder kit.
Yeah, yeah.
And what about Cytomax? Isn't that exactly what you just described?
So Cytomax is the product that has lactate in it, and Professor Brooks was saying that a number of cycling teams used it and it was very popular back in the day. But it's an interesting kind of like business story in that the company that made Cytomax was also making Muscle Milk. And then someone bought Cytomax and Muscle Milk because they wanted Muscle Milk and then didn't really care about Cytomax.
Oh, really?
So Cytomax is kind of a bit of a sideshow to Muscle Milk. And
yeah, I've used it back in the day. I was joking with Julie, I'm back on the Cytomax. Yeah, Lactate's back in fashion, baby.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it'd be interesting if we could be fashionable again. I think Cytomax doesn't have all that much in it. So they don't, it's a proprietary blend. So of course you don't know how much.
Oh, you don't know how much.
You don't know much lactate you're getting on their label. So we know from the science paper how much was in the solution that they tested, but whether or not that's still, especially given that Cytomax has changed owners, whether or not that's still what's in Cytomax is another thing altogether. So it would be interesting to test that out.
And from a sports science perspective, do you know if anyone ever went beyond just mechanistic stuff with L-lactate? Did they look at, I don't know, what kind of performance measure you would look at? Probably something horrible like time to exhaustion that we don't care about. But did anyone look at anything like that, where, you know, something where it's closer to what we actually care about rather than just some mechanistic thing?
So the paper that I was just referring to where they did the labeling, they did also do the time to, I think it was either time to exhaustion or a fixed time trial. But there's only one paper. So still more work to be done there. I believe that they maybe also had some animal studies as well. But it just seemed like it was in its infancy and there was a promising result and then nobody looked at it again.
Was it a mouse on a stationary bicycle doing a Wingate test?
No, there was a human. There were humans involved at some point. There was humans involved at some point.
You know, there's also some overlap with the ketones in the... It's L-lactate that we're talking about.
So there's isoform specificity with lactate as well. I mean, I was reading this review and I got really like, I enjoyed nerding out about it because it was just so similar, all of the same issues between lactate and ketones, like isoform specificity, the transporters all being the same, the way that they're feeding into metabolism. And it was very interesting to me how similar that they were. And I think it's potentially something that could synergize really well in the future.
And do you know if D-lactate has any role in metabolism?
It's definitely, there's more evidence to suggest that D-lactate is harmful than there is L-beta-hydroxybutyrate being harmful.
I can connect the dots for our listeners as well. I recently discovered, so there was this big hoo-ha with D-lactate-free probiotics and is the gut making too much D-lactate, and you can measure it on a urinary organic acids test. They measure the D form. And it turns out, and I know this from Jason Horolak, his research has shown it's really only a problem in people with surgically shortened bowels. It's like that's the only place you'll find evidence that D-lactate is a neurotoxin.
Yeah.
But if anyone listening has seen anything else that we should look at, then I would love to see that.
Both with, again, ketones and lactate. So butyrate being a very important fatty acid that the gut produces and lactate being an important fermentation product of the gut microbiome. I think, you know, not only are these things going to be affecting metabolism in the body, but potentially also shifting the gut microbiome in somewhat way as well. So, I mean, so many unanswered questions here that we've got to unpick.
Yeah, you reminded me that we were talking about Roseburia and some of these other butyrate producing bacteria and how important the butyrate is for the colonic cells.
There's a really interesting review about the role of butyrate in kind of gut health and metabolism, and they also talk about the potential for supplementing that with exogenous ketones. And interestingly enough, they've patented that combination. I know you and I were talking about how patenting kind
closes
out the doors for other people, but there's clearly there's some interest and value in that idea. Otherwise, they wouldn't have gone to the effort of getting a patent on it. But I don't know. The more I read about the gut microbiome, the more I think it's going to be pretty difficult to affect like really meaningful and lasting changes and really work out what we want for everyone. But, you know, clearly you can do it with a ketogenic diet and gut's super important.
Right. So I should probably say something about the patents. My problem with patents is, so what we've seen in software is this situation where people end up holding a gun to each other's head, right? So it's like this triad. We've got everybody's pointing a gun at somebody else. So
in the NAD space, right? Elysium and Chromadex. And that's really bad too.
It's terrible. So what happened in software? You know, so you infringed my stupid one-click ordering pattern. But, you also infringed my pattern. So, just call it quits. I'm holding one pattern. You're holding one pattern. And so these big players, they end up being people like IBM and Apple, these huge companies, Intel. And then what happens is the little guys get squeezed out because they don't have any patents and they don't have the financial capability to defend any of them.
Yeah, I think that's more it, right? You could take out a patent, but that in itself costs money. But then if someone infringes on it, you have to have the money to defend it. And if you're defending against IBM, their pockets are going to be much deeper.
Good
than
luck with
yours,
that. So you just end up, it thwarts innovation because the little guys are pushed out.
But also, I think if you didn't have it, then you could be a little guy and then the big guy could just take it anyway. So, I mean, I don't think there's an easy solution here. I mean, have you got a solution?
Well, yeah, you just make it totally open.
So anyone can just take anything from anyone.
Yeah. That's how software worked in the beginning, right?
Yeah.
Richard Stallman has given some really interesting lectures on this. So he's the president of the Free Software Foundation. And that's how it worked. It was like recipes. If you turned up for someone's house for dinner and you said, I really like that casserole, can you give me the recipe? They would just write it down on a piece of paper and give it to you.
Yeah, I don't know, though. I feel like, especially coming from like the science academic background, if you put blood, sweat and tears into developing something, a scientist doesn't necessarily have the skills of an e-commerce company or a marketing company. So, you know, I as a scientist could try and sell things myself, but there's always going to be someone better at, like, how would I get credit for my invention, or, you know, have an incentive to invent?
So there's two things that's important not to conflate. There's like freedom as in speech, and then there's freedom as in how much you charge for the thing, right? You think about it, Android and to a certain extent Apple are running flavors of Unix that's built on open source software, which is free as in speech and free as in beer. But they've still managed to commercialize those products, right? Mm. Red Hat Linux is built on Linux, which is free as in speech and free as in beer.
Yeah.
So it can be done, but it's not, it's tricky. And you guys have got enough to worry about, so I do worry about that too.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting layer to, having come from just doing the research, trying to like layer on top of regulatory and marketing and IP.
Yeah,
and there's so much to it, and you really need experts from every field to advise you and to make the right decisions.
Yeah, I'm absolutely not a patent lawyer.
No.
So who knows?
And software is very different to nutrition.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Talk about the GI symptoms paper.
Yeah, so I was just telling Chris before we came on that this morning I had a paper accepted into the International Journal of Sports Nutrition and Medicine. I might have got the title of the journal a bit wrong, but it's something along those lines.
We'll cite it. So Elaine makes fantastic show notes that you can find over at nourishbalancethrive.com/podcast, or if you poke around inside of your podcast app, you'll find the show notes and there'll
links.
Be all the citations will be there.
Yep. So this paper, I imagine by the time the podcast goes live, hopefully the paper, the abstract or something will be live. But for me, this paper was a culmination of an awful lot of conversations that I'd had with people that were using the ketone ester. And also, I think we might have discussed on a previous podcast, there was a paper that came out that looked at acetoacetate esters and cyclists, and they showed that people had a lot of GI symptoms after the acetoacetate ester. So people were coming to me concerned about side effects of ketone drinks. And, you know, I've been working with these drinks now for like 8-9 years and given them to tons of people at rest and exercise, and if I'd been making people sick every time I gave them a drink, I wouldn't have carried on. Like, you know, I don't want to inflict like pain on people. I'm not a nasty person. I'm a nice person. So it didn't feel right as a scientist to just be like, trust me, you'll probably be all right, almost certain you'll be all right. I wanted to have something more kind of concrete. And then I was looking back at all the data I had from my PhD, and I'd actually, every time I'd given someone a drink in all of my years of studies, I'd been asking them about their symptoms at every time point that I sampled their blood. So I had this huge data set, and actually I probably should have come to you, Chris, and you could have done some better analysis on it than me, but I had this huge data set of ketone levels versus symptoms, and the symptoms were broken down into upper, lower and systemic symptoms. And within upper GI symptoms, it was like bloating, nausea, I can't remember what the third one was, vomiting, nobody had that. And then lower GI, it would be like abdominal pain, diarrhea, flatulence, and then systemic was headache, dizziness and another. But, you know, so we had like a lot of granular detail about exactly what symptoms people were getting, but then also about the severity of those symptoms. And it really was frustrating me that people would report in papers like 50% of people had a headache, because that doesn't tell you about like when the headache happened, how severe it was, or, you know, any of those details that are kind of important. So when people look at these things, it's like, oh, it's 1 out of 8. But then if you just report very simply, it's like, oh, headache. It doesn't tell you that
it's
not particularly severe. So what I was trying to do was to present my data in a way that captured a little bit more of that detail. So the time course, the severity and the type of symptoms. So in the paper, we talk a little bit about the differences between esters and salts. And again, like those of us in the community that have used all of these compounds know that if you take too much ketone salt or MCT, that you might get diarrhea because it's salty, it gives you GI distress. That's like...
It's true of anything. You can drink too much olive oil and make yourself run to the bathroom.
Too much
vitamin C will do it.
Yeah, for sure. Nasty. But the esters don't tend to have that sort of same effect.
Mm-hmm.
The esters, it might be more like you might have like a bit of a headache or feel a little bit dizzy or something like that, but didn't get that so much with the salt. So what we're trying to tease out is which symptoms happen with which compound? Do they change with dose? And then the final study that I included was an exercise study. And this hopefully is going to vindicate a lot of people that kind of criticize these compounds, because it was a 3-hour exercise protocol and people were taking either a ketone drink or a carb drink every hour during the exercise. And with both drinks, the symptoms just slowly increase over time. People just like felt worse, and there was no difference whether people had ketones or carbs. So for me, I think it's really a very kind of boring paper, because it's like not much happens.
I knew, yeah.
Yeah, for me, it's pretty boring, but I'm really pleased that there's finally like a formal source for people to go and look at and be like, okay, this is the chance of symptoms with these different drinks, you know, because I think athletes want to know, well, my peak likelihood of having symptoms is about X amount after the drink. So I'm just going to make sure that I account for that in when I'm taking it. Or the difference, again, between making the choice between salts and esters, other than just the BHB levels, it's like, well, if I'm going to take salts, it's maybe a bit more likely that I'm going to end up with diarrhea. And the chance of that is higher when I'm exercising anyway. So do I really want to do that? Maybe, maybe not. So I think for me, it's just sort of satisfying to see that data, which, you know, I knew myself, sort of formally presented so that people can refer to it and that I can refer to it in conversations. So
was this motivated in any way by the trouble that Louise Burke had with their pharmacokinetics?
The aceto acetate paper, yeah. I mean, that...
What did she do? She ordered a research chemical from the internet and then just loaded up some...
She ordered a research chemical from Dom, and Dom gave it to her. Dom D'Agostino gave it to her. And I think they were on a bit of a time pressure, so they ran the study kind of without having done all of the pharmacokinetics that they needed.
Or any of the pharmacokinetics.
I'm looking forward to being on a panel with Louise Burke at the ACSM, American College of Sports Medicine meeting, in about a month or so's time. So I'm not going to get too personal. But if she tries to tack too much on the ketone ester, then I think, you know, I would love to hear her answer as to how she got her ethics committee to agree to giving people a compound that had never before been formally studied in humans, because I'd love to hear how she did that.
Maybe she intoxicated them with some research chemical.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe she gave it to them beforehand. Although if they'd done that, then I don't think they'd have given it to the athletes.
I am, of course, joking.
Yeah.
Talk about nutritional ketoacidosis during incremental exercise in healthy athletes.
Well, you got through that very quickly. So that is another research paper that's just been published out of the University of Oxford. So a couple of my colleagues that I worked on with at Marum Research. And I think actually I'm a participant in this study. I think I'm one of the data points.
That's cool.
So it was before I left Oxford that they were doing this study. And again, I think it's just... there's so much work to do characterizing these molecules. So looking at the effects of ketones on acid-base balance and on sort of step test. So how it affects, if you're a regular athlete and you do a step test, you're looking for your ventilatory threshold and your lactate threshold. And those are measures that you're using to determine if your training is working. And so what we show, what the researchers show in this paper is that taking ketones shifts the ventilatory threshold and the lactate threshold. So it's... changing those numbers in ways that may be beneficial, but definitely would confound your conventional interpretation of your step test results. Another thing which I think is kind of interesting about that paper is that people always worry that ketones are going to scrub off top end power. And again, we've got quite a substantial level of ketosis here and no difference in top end power. So I think that's good to see as well. But really, the paper is kind of going into detail about how the relationship between ketones as an organic acid and lactate as an organic acid, and maybe the, you know, needing to compensate for that acid load with changes to ventilatory threshold, and how all of these very fundamental exercise physiology principles all kind of interplay in together. And so it's a nice little study.
There was one other study I wanted to talk about. Finally, which was, oh yeah, beta-hydroxybutyrate and inflammation.
Oh,
so there
yeah.
was that early paper that I saw cited a lot on the inflammasome. But that was kind of, I mean, maybe talk about that original paper first, because it was kind of...
2013. And I think Dom, I don't know whether he's an author on it, but he collaborated with Dixit's group, and I think they're in Harvard. But yeah, so I love this story. So basically, everyone's been thinking that BHB... interacts with the inflammasome and inhibits inflammation. There was this original paper, I think it was published in Nature or Science, it was published in a high impact factor journal. And then recently there's been more and more animal studies and in vitro studies that have shown that if you apply ketones to the system, that there is reduced NLRP3 inflammasome activation. So I kind of feel like the community was starting to take that as a given. So now we have ketone esters and we can raise BHB acutely and look at inflammation. What's going to happen? Completely the opposite to what people expected. We actually saw that adding ketone ester in, if you then trigger an immune response, the inflammatory response is greater. Now, I think that the way that they presented their results is maybe a little, like, maybe not quite how I'd have done it. So they presented in the title of the paper was that oral ketone ester acutely increased NLRP3 activation in human monocytes. And now what actually they did was people either had placebo drink or ketone drink, and they had a blood sample before and a blood sample 30 minutes after the drinks. Now, when they took the blood samples, they split the blood samples in half, and one half was just left as is, and the other half LPS was applied to. So LPS is a bacterial toxin that profoundly stimulates inflammation. And so in the unstimulated samples, ketones or no, there's no extra inflammation. So I feel like the presentation of the data was that ketones increased activation just as is in kind of a basal state. But actually, that's not what we saw. If there's no bacteria present, it's not going to, ketones themselves were not inflammatory by themselves. However, when you needed an immune response, so when you pop in those bacterial toxins and you want there to be an immune response, there was greater activation of parts of the innate immune system, such as caspase 1, and there was increased IL-1 beta secretion and increased IL-6 secretion as well with ketosis, with the ketone drinks. And that's again like kind of counter to what people might have expected, but actually in line with one other paper that came out last year, which you'll love this. I don't know how they got ethics to do this. They infused people with LPS, which is a bacterial toxin. It was done in Denmark, I think. I don't know how they got the ethics.
So they induced sepsis.
Yeah, so they induced sepsis and infused ketones in a crossover design, so either LPS by itself or LPS plus ketones. And they also saw an increased IL-1 beta response as well. So maybe ketones are there, are like actually boosting the immune response. So the presentation was that of the paper was that ketones actually activated inflammation, but I think that they didn't lean super heavily on the fact that that might be what you want in bacterial toxin infection land. So it's interesting because it goes counter to all of the animal work that's been done to date. So we really need to like tease into the context of this, see whether, you know, the time course, so they only did that one sampling time point 30 minutes after the drink. And so there's a number of things. And also in that experiment, their control was just water, calorie free. And so if you're providing substrate to the cells in forms of ketones versus an overnight fast, maybe this difference in substrate availability could have affected immune cell activation. So it might just be the cells where you had the ketone drink had more energy because you'd had the ketone drink, and that's why there was an augmented response. And also interestingly, and I know Tommy and I have a number of interesting discussions about this, there was a really small increase in insulin after the ketone drink. Now, I always like to keep this in context. So normally the increase that you see is sort of like from 3 milliunits per liter to 6 milliunits per liter. So it's doubling, but in context, if you eat a carb-rich meal, your insulin will go up to like 40 or 50 milliunits per liter. So it's really, really, really small increase in insulin, but there nonetheless. And insulin is another factor that can activate the immune response. So without controlling for that, they didn't have an insulin increase with the placebo drink. So again, it's like, for me, I would need to see whether substrate made a difference, whether insulin made a difference, before I could say whether actually the ketones themselves are boosting the inflammatory response.
And I think Tommy also pointed out that it was a very small study with very badly done statistics, right?
So Tommy's really great at statistics.
That's his pet thing, isn't it? Yeah, I don't want to speak for him too much, but yeah, I did understand one of the problems he pointed out. The distribution was clearly not normal, and they reported the mean and the standard deviation with error bars, and it was, you could just look at it. And so, you know, you don't need to be a statistician to understand that if Bill Gates walks into a crowded room, then on average, everybody's a millionaire, right?
Yes.
And it was that exact problem, but in a published paper. And
yeah, I mean, it's the way with science. I think they did a good job because they do present all of their individual data, so you can actually see,
you could see it was not a normal distribution.
But yeah, some of the statistics wasn't quite appropriate. And Tommy says that you should always use non-parametric statistics because like that's correct no matter whether it's normally distributed or not. So I mean, I'm definitely not a statistics whiz, so I'm not going to criticize anyone else's statistics.
I've definitely made that mistake as well, actually. One of our clients pointed out I made it in the blood chemistry calculator where some of our scores, like the 5-year wellness score, for example, is also not normally distributed, or the toxicity score is not normally distributed, but I reported the mean and the standard deviation, so I need to fix that too. Yeah, I'm definitely a sinner there too.
Yeah, Tommy helped me with the stats for this GI paper that just came out as well, so he knows what he's talking about. And I think, I mean, it just really highlights that presentation and interpretation really can colour how that is then received by the public. And you can't expect everyone to be as good at Tommy as statistics, and you can't expect everyone to read the statistical methods thoroughly enough to really understand. And so I think, you know, analysis and then presentation of that data. Because I think with the inflammation paper, there's a line in the methods that's like, IL-1 beta is not reported for unstimulated samples because it was undetectable. Mm-hmm. But that's the only time in the paper that they really mention or highlight at all that just taking ketones really didn't do anything into inflammation, because that's like a non-result, not that interesting. But for me, I think in order to put people's minds at rest, it's actually kind of important to say, look, drinking ketones isn't inflammatory. Because when you take these unstimulated samples where there's no bacterial toxin added, there's no immune response. Mm-hmm. So I think it just really highlights, not only is there a sort of a right or wrong way to do things statistically, but you can also, just from what you choose to focus on when you write the paper, really color the interpretation of that kind of thing.
Does it not make you sad that you need a statistician to tell you whether you got something or not? You know, you do your experiment and then you give the data to somebody else and they tell you whether you've got something or not.
I'd rather it was that way. In a way, that would be like a great way to do science, because then that avoids the investigator either doing stats badly or picking and choosing what analyses they're going to actually focus on. You know, I think actually having an independent statistician do the analysis might be kind of good for all experiments.
But, you know, what I'm driving at, though, is like, you know, like as soon as you see the data, like, okay, we got something here. Like, you don't need to do some clever statistics to know whether you got an effect or not.
Not in every case.
Okay.
Sometimes it looks like it's really different, but there's such big variability. You know, it looks like the means are kind of similar, but there's that much variability that it's not statistically different. And so I think it's a good check and balance and like gut check on, you know, I think on the flip side, I agree with you that people like p-hack and do stats badly and, you know, will say something significant when it's small and clinically insignificant. So, I mean, I think there's just two sides to that argument. I think, you know, it's still a bit like the patent thing. It's like a necessary evil, probably could be done better, but without it, then, you know, until we have a better solution,
right,
we gotta stick with it.
Cool. Well, yeah. I want to be respectful of your time. You've got a hard stop in 3 minutes. In 3 minutes, you're going to have to tell us all about the ketone monoester, where we can find it online,
sure,
where we can find you online, some of the content that you're producing. You're doing a podcast, you're doing other written material. Tell us all about it.
If you're interested in just following what I'm up to, I'm on Twitter at Brianna Stubbs. If you're interested to follow what HVMN is up to, we're at HVMN, and we're also on Instagram as well. Our website is hvmn.com. You can go on there and you can buy the ketone ester, but also we've put loads and loads of effort into some really great blog series about the ketogenic diet and athletic training and all of those things as well. We have our own podcast, as you just said. It's the HVMN podcast. You can get that on Apple, and we're also on YouTube as well if you want to see my pretty face chatting away. Anything else I should mention? I mean, yeah, we're just really keen to hear from people who are in the community and interested in the same stuff as us, so reach out and we'll definitely get back to you.
Thank you very much. I very much appreciate you, and I hope that I can catch up with you again in the future.
Of course, it's always a pleasure.
I hope that people felt like I sufficiently wrung as much information out of you as physically possible in an hour. It's not this, you've got so much in there, it's kind of hard.
We could talk for hours. you as well.
Thank you, Bri.
Thanks,
really appreciate
Chris.
You. Cheers. Just before you go, very quickly, Ivy, can you say for me, Francisco?
Francisco.
Very good. Thank you.